languages to come, and to those of you who are here, a very warm welcome here. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Stephen Finn. Those of you who attended his course last year will know he's absolutely superb, and I think from what I can gather, you're in for a superb week. If you tell me very briefly about Stephen Finn, Professor Finn. Stephen Finn has been a farmhand, a journalist, and a photographer. He's taught at all levels, including at primary schools, at high schools, colleges, and at three universities. He studied and actually obtained degrees in English, psychology, and communication from five universities, has published over 60 academic articles and five books, and has delivered papers at conferences in 12 countries on five continents. Amazing, isn't it? His topics range from propaganda, war writing, and contemporary literature to religion, and war writing, artistic expression through the ages. Although he has a doctorate in communication on political propaganda, Stephen Finn is actually professor of English and has a master's degree in English literature, and acted as head of the Department of English at the University of Victoria. When he resigned from academia to pursue a career as a novelist and playwright, the University of Victoria conferred the title of Professor Emeritus of him. His novel, Soliloquy, was acclaimed in the national press and regarded as a Book of the Year by the Metropolitan League. Professor Finn has won many awards in diverse fields, which range from his teaching ability and his research to a Rotary Graduate Fellowship for studying in the USA, to being the South African Body for Life Grand Champion a couple of years back, and has also won the Toastmasters International Best Speaker of the World Competition. Now, he's also a vegan and an animal rights activist, and his interests include literature, classical music, and cutting-edge art. Please give Professor Finn a round of applause.
Thank you, Madam. Hi, everybody. It's lovely to see you, so many of you, and quite a few I recognized from last year. And I know you're all passionate about Shakespeare. I know you've all read everything Shakespeare ever wrote. And you've committed it to memory. But in case you haven't, Shakespeare, of course, has the greatest reputation among all writers, certainly all playwrights. And I'm not going to give his history, except to say this will come a bit later. From about 1590, from about 1584 to 1592, we know nothing about the man, we don't know where he was. He wrote all kinds of plays, and his sources come from the historian Holinshed, Old Norse Tale, that's Hamlet, Plutarch, Ovid, Virgil, folk tales. But the question is, why have I chosen Italy? I've chosen it because I find his works intriguing. And really, when I read various of his plays, I thought, no, this must be wrong. How can he say this? Wow, this is interesting. Which plays are related to Italy? Well, of course, in ancient Rome, we've got Julius Caesar, Coriolanus, Titus Andronicus. Has anyone read Titus Andronicus? Good, keep it that way. Yes. Also, The Tale of the Shrew, the first act of Othello, All That Ends Well, Muttered About Nothing, The Winter's Tale, and possibly A Midsummer Night's Dream. I'm not doing any of those. So, what have I chosen? Well, I've chosen these four plays. Romeo and Juliet, Two Gentlemen of Verona, Merchant of Venice, and Tempest. Why? They all take place in similar areas. Romeo and Juliet in Verona, Two Gentlemen of Verona in Verona and Milan, The Merchant of Venice in, and Tempest, well, it's an interesting one because we're not quite sure, but Crossroad is the new club of Milan. So what you'll see there is a book. We've got Venice, we've got Milan up there, and Verona and Why else have I chosen these? Because everyone knows Romeo and Juliet, right?
Yeah.
Nobody knows Two Gentlemen of Verona, right? Wrong! And people have misinterpreted The Merchant of Venice for centuries. And The Tempest can be interpreted in really very many ways. Now, not even worse. Why have I chosen this? Because we've got a tragedy, Romeo and Juliet, a comedy, Two Gentlemen of Verona, a dark comedy, which could well be a tragedy, Merchant of Venice, and what, about 200 years ago, was classified as a romance, because they didn't know what else to classify it as, and that's The Tempest. So we have two early plays, Romeo and Juliet and Two Gentlemen of Verona, a middle play, The Merchant, and a late play. Now, I'm going to take a different approach for every play. The first two lectures, I'm going to talk generally about it, about the plays, and Romeo and Juliet and Two Gentlemen of Verona, but I'll be more focused on particular scenes and lines and go through the play bit by bit in The Merchant of Venice on Wednesday and Thursday and The Tempest on Friday. What they all have in common is things aren't what they seem to be and things aren't what you've been led to believe. And of course, as I said in the blurb, I hope particularly on Thursday and Friday to blow your minds. But this is going to be like a Shakespeare play. Five acts, they're all linked. We're going to start with Romeo and Juliet because that's comfortable, introducing various scenes. Two Gentlemen of Verona because that's a disastrous play. But it's really important, as I'll explain why tomorrow. And then the complication in The Merchant of Venice and the resolution, which is no resolution, in The Tempest. Now, for each play, I give the date of composition, a synopsis. Would you like a synopsis? Yes? All those who want a synopsis each time? Thank you. Okay. I'll refer to the possible sources of the play, and we'll look at various speeches, and then something unusual. Putting the play in geographical or historical or social context. I should finish each play when I say I'll finish, but if I don't worry. I'll just lead one into the other, or I'll start another early. So let's get on to Romeo and Juliet, of course. Leonard Warren Olivia Hussey, that's just even there. I presume most of us saw that when it came out. Yeah, it was lovely. And we all know that Romeo and Juliet has been in the collective mind for 400 years about with West Side Story, with Leonard Bernstein and Sondheim. Peter Ustinov wrote a play about this, which was made into a film which I never saw, called Romanoff and Juliet. Ballet, Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev, one of my favorite ballet, Prokofiev one. Okay, when was it written? Nobody knows. They think between 1591 and 1596, because it was first performed in 1596. It was his second tragedy. The first was the melodramatic Crisis of Bronicus. And of course I've read it, but I've only had the misfortune of seeing the first half once. I walked out after that. And Romeo and Juliet is based on a poem by the English writer Arthur Brooke called Romeo and Juliet. But where did Brooke get this from? Well, from the 16th century Italian writer of novellas, Matteo Bandello. Where did Vangelo get his ideas from? The immediate source was Luigi del Porto's Giulietta and Romeo, which was about 1530. And he was the first to set this rather old story in Verona and give the two lovers these names. By the way, it was after Brookhart Heber that introduced the character of the nurse, but Mercutio is Shakespeare's invention. However, the story is really archetypal, especially if we think of Hero and Leander. You remember the former hero is a priestess, and the latter is some virile guy who swam across the Dardanelles every night, even without steroids, to make love to her, guided by her lamp, until the storm blew the lamp out one night, and he drowned, subsequent to which she killed herself. More appositely, we have the story of Pyramus and Thisbe, which Shakespeare also uses in Midsummer Night's Dream. And Midsummer Night's Dream, evidently, was written just after Romeo and Juliet, and so Shakespeare makes the story his own. In fact, as we know from Midsummer Night's Dream, he subverts the story of Pyramus and Thisbe. It's absolutely hilarious, as Benjamin Britten does it in his Othello Midsummer Night's Dream as well. But it seems actually that in Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare is mocking Romeo and Juliet as well. Okay. In the original story, Pyramus and Thisbe live in adjoining houses and have parents who detest each other, being engaged in a long-running feud. The would-be lovers communicate through a crack in the wall, and they arrange to meet. Now, Thisbe, who is female, is frightened by a lioness with a bloody mouth. She can devour something else. And in fleeing, she drops her veil. That's Thisbe, not the lioness. The lioness rips the veil to pieces and saunters off. Pyramus arrives, thinks that his almost lover has been killed, that he committed suicide. Thisbe returns, sees the body, and uses his dagger to kill himself. It's all very sad, of course, and it sounds a lot like Romeo and Juliet. Now, 4 minutes, the synopsis. Just to remind you, no matter how we know this one, Romeo and Juliet is a story of two teenage lovers in Verona who are caught in a bitter feud between their families, the Montagues and the Capulets. We are introduced to Romeo, a Montague, who is besotted with Rosaline and is exhausted by his unrequited lovesickness. We must remember this, because we get this in Two Gentlemen of Verona, we get it in The Merchant of Venice as well. He's exhausted because his lovesickness is unrequited. Now, his two closest mates, Benvolio and Mercutio, manage to get him to attend a party being given by Romeo's daddy's arch enemy, Capulet. Romeo goes because all he wants to do is pine over the most beautiful girl in the world, Rosaline, who will evidently be at the party, and by who he knows, he'll be captivated forever. At the party, however, he sees Juliet, totally smitten by her, knows he'll be captivated by her forever. He actually manages to kiss her, and when the others push off, he remains in hiding. Later that night, Juliet goes to the window, Romeo in a way. They express their love for each other, manage to get Friar Lawrence to marry them the next morning. Now, it's not sure who's the quicker worker here, but remember, Juliet is not yet, she's actually not quite 14, and Romeo is most probably just a couple of years older. And Juliet's nurse, who's really funny and is as coarse as sandpaper, fetches a rope ladder to allow Romeo to climb up in the night, because, unlike Rapunzel, Juliet's hair isn't long enough to let down. Meanwhile, on the way home, Romeo and Mercutio, who is a magnificent creation, and talks more than I do, and is talking all about who I'm conquer, sexual illusions, and sick humor. And they challenge by Tybalt, Juliet's cousin, who runs Mercutio through with his sword. Mercutio dies. As he dies, he shouts out, "A plague on both your houses." Now, just as we're saying two houses, because if it was in Kantla, he's going to say it. And then Romeo kills Tybalt. The prince arrives and promptly banishes Romeo. In the meantime, Juliet is told by mommy and daddy she's going to marry Paris, who's got the hots for her, not that he's spoken to her. She's rather distraught, as she's already married. But daddy insists, and mommy says she's already old. She's really an old maid. I mean, she hasn't been brought to bed. She's already 13. She says that. Then that evening, Romeo climbs up to the window, and they have a sensitive time in bed. He pushes off at dawn and asks Friar Lawrence what to do because she's going to marry Paris. And the priest, she goes to Friar Lawrence, okay. The priest gives her a potion that will make her sleep for 42 hours with a semblance of death. The next morning, her nurse, mother, father, and Paris find her ostensibly dead, and she's carted off to the capital too, where she dies next to next to a slowly decomposing Tybalt. Friar Lawrence sends a message telling Romeo what actually happened, sent to Mantua, where Romeo has fled, but the messenger doesn't make it. However, Romeo learns that Juliet has died, so he goes to an apothecary for poison. He then returns to Verona and Juliet's tomb. Paris is mourning outside, so Romeo kills him. He then drags him into the tomb, after breaking into it, to let him lie next to a slowly recovering Juliet and a rapidly rotting Tybalt. Romeo takes the poison and dies. Juliet wakes up to see Friar Lawrence, who's just arrived to get matters right, but it's too late, of course. The meddling friar then pushes up because he hears others arriving. Juliet sees the dead Tybalt, the dead Paris, and most importantly, the dead Romeo. Put the cutie at all the notes somewhere else. And he's distraught that she takes Romeo's death and kills herself. After that, the family arrive, except Romeo's mother, who's died in the meantime. The two of them shake hands and say that they've been rather stupid and engaged in a feud for all these years. And the prince sums up the event with a bit of help from the friar, and they all die happily ever after. So, let's get to Verona now. A couple of years ago, I was there with my wife and two of my children, and under duress, I said, okay, we could go to Juliet's supposed house. I'm sure that quite a few of you have been there, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Right. It's totally ridiculous, of course. It's all fiction. Other people flock there, as we all did, and leave notes all over the wall. Remember those notes that you get to? Expressing their love. And who needs Facebook and Twitter if you have a wall? We even saw messages written on chewing gum wrappers, American, and in Russian, Greek, Chinese, I think, and Afrikaans. Some expressed their love, and others asked Juliet to intercede for them. They all seem to forget that Romeo and Juliet is a love story gone wrong. That the two had just one night of bliss and then were miserable afterwards, eventually committing suicide. Is this the love, the passion that they really want? Of course not. But St. Juliet is beatified there. And then there's a sculpture. Rub Juliet's breast, her right breast, and good luck will come your way. It didn't really help Romeo. The most ridiculous was the balcony, right up there. You know that people have wedding photos over there? I believe he's was a Czech soccer player. When we were there, a very Russian or Czech or Bulgarian appeared in a Slavic language, went right up to the balcony, saw him tone something like, sounds suspiciously like Romanov, Romanov, Wunder, Kunde, Wunder, Wunder. Okay. And then some African girl succeeded him up there, and no doubt hoping to be discovered a la Charlize Theron, Spartan, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore after Romeo? And say right below, I found out his name later, Charlemagne, I am here, Juliet. And so much for South African education. But why, for what reason? he's a Mongolian, and Juliet mutters this because he doesn't know why the boy who kissed her better than Johnny Depp has to be a Montague. Okay, fine. And then we have a wretched balcony. It wasn't Juliet's at all, but was erected in the 1930s so that people like Sabrant and his beloved could act out the play. In fact, making things more absurd, in the play, Juliet doesn't have a balcony at all. She's at her window. So the whole story of romance in the balcony is a chimera, an illusion. Hold on, but Shakespeare must have got the story from somewhere. But, yeah, but we know from Brooke and Balganello, or Mandela, but could it have been true? How much is it original? So we must actually look for literary proof. Now in Act 1, Scene 1, Lady Montague, Romeo's mummy, asks his best friend, Benvolio, where her little boy is. We know that he's moping, because he's desperately in love with Rosaline, who's not interested in him. Benvolio tells her that he saw Romeo an hour before sunrise. These Romans are the Veroneses, really got up early. He saw him walking under a grove of sycamores to the west of the city. Okay, at one scene, two, 112, 113 pages. Now, interestingly enough, sycamores are not mentioned in any of Shakespeare's sources. Not in Brooke, not in Bandello, and not in Del Corto. We know that our playwright has a perfect imagination, say he could have just been going to extraneous detail. However, the writer, Richard Paul Rowe, points out that even today, there is a sycamore grove to the west of the city. How the heck did Shakespeare know that, had he not himself being to Verona? Any answers from anybody?
Traveller
told me from here, but anyone else?
He didn't write the play.
He didn't write the play. But if he never did write the play, he must have been to Verona to see the sycamores.
Brooke.
Brooke.
A painting. I think you're all making a big sort of sense, yes. I think, however, that it's possible that Rowe, who said there are sycamores there, and yes, there are sycamores there, missed one point. The sycamores could well have been planted in response to the play. And after Shakespeare, I was terribly excited when I read this the first time. I have to wait a second. What certainly did exist was Freetown, also known in other sources as Villa Franca, that the awful prince, I really don't like him, you'll find out by now, refers to in Act 1, Scene 1, line 93, if you want to look it up, 1193. When after the first cracker, he says, "You, Capulet, shall go along with me, and Montague, come you this afternoon to know our father pleasure in his case, to old Freetown, our common judgment place." There it is. Freetown. Now, a lot of writers have said that Freetown is actually the castle belonging to Capulet, because they managed to trace it as belonging to Capulet in the 14th century. But however, if the prince, who is supposed to be the arbiter of justice, if he is saying, we are going to Capulet, we are going to Freetown. He is saying, we're going to Capulet's house. And if he says, Capulet, you're coming with me. And after we've discussed things, you, Montague, you can come and hear what our judgment is. He's showing favoritism, isn't he? Okay. But we're told at the beginning of the play that these are two households alike in dignity, in social status. When Romeo kills Tybalt, and is really genuinely sorry about it, the prince is biased. He doesn't give Romeo a chance really to explain himself. He just banishes him. Is that fair? No. Actually, things are rotten in the state of Verona. And they were rotten when the real story of Romeo and Juliet occurred. But what's the real story? Well, when we were in Verona, a few people, they weren't tour guides, told us that Romeo and Juliet really did live in the 14th century, and some even said it was 1302. I haven't found real proof, except in Dante's Purgatorio. Now, Dante's Purgatorio was written in the early 14th century, I think about 1309, 14th century. And he says in the Purgatorio the following. I'll give it in English, not in Italian, for two reasons. Most of you can't understand Italian. The other reason is I can't either. He says, Dante says, in Purgatorio, come, you who paid no heed, do come and see Montecchi, Capaletti, sad already. Montecchi, Montecchi. Capaletti, Capulet. So there must have been something there. So what does all this tell us? It isn't unlikely that two youngsters like Romeo and Juliet did actually live and die in the 14th century, and that their story went down in poetry until it was written down and made famous by Shakespeare. Now this is regarded as a great love story. And I know it is prescribed throughout this country, various schools, for pupils. I refuse to use the word learners in this but for pupils, because, for example, yes, right. But it's the fact that it is a great love story, that is ridiculous. But then, if we look at the other tragedies, some are also really silly. Othello kills his wife because she doesn't have a handkerchief. King Lear goes mad because nobody wants him. Macbeth kills a king and destroys a country because of three fortune tellers. Hamlet's action or inaction is motivated by a ghost. Cleopatra dies because he plays with a snake, and Shakespeare knows that Liz Taylor would need a meaty role one day. On the other hand, all of these plays have the most magnificent language. Most of the action is understandable, well, almost. And Shakespeare shows an amazing insight into character. So what about Romeo and Juliet, the play? We have two hilarious figures, Mercutio and the nurse. But the rest aren't all that exciting. Old men bicker and young men quarrel and kill each other. Romeo really remains a love-besotted adolescent whose hormones lead him everywhere. Even though he says at one stage that there's more to love than sex, he's not fooling anyone. The one who's the luckiest in the play and the cleverest is Rosalind, because she ignores him. Juliet starts off as an immature little girl, all submissive and sweet, But after Romeo kisses her, she matures exponentially, becomes a fully fledged woman, totally in charge of her decisions, her life and her death. All this in a couple of days, a bit extreme maybe. However, the story grabs adolescents even today. You know, it's been there, done that, got the tattoo bit. Also, it has wonderful close to the knuckle, bawdy sexual humour that youngsters and their teachers and their lecturers really go for, making the pupils of today realise that their dirty little minds can be fed furiously by fornicating abomination. Look at the sad Romeo, who's trying desperately to seduce Rosaline. Act 1, Scene 1, line 203. Sorry, is there anybody here under the age of 16? Right. He says, she will not stay the siege of loving terms, nor buy the encounter of assailing eyes, nor ope her lap to saint seducing gold. He really thinks about himself. Or the nurse calls Juliet, Act 1, Scene 3, Line 3, 133. She calls her Ladybird, which means both sweetheart and prostitute in Shakespeare's day. I wonder what Lyndon Baines Johnson, who gave his wife a Ladybird, what did he use that? Okay. Now, this Ladybird can lead to a major discussion about whether Juliet is a slut or not. Romeo certainly is. On Mercutio, Act 2, Scene 1, line 249, for that long, 2-1, lines 24 to 29. Mercutio, with his play on the erotic, the erect penis, the vagina, sexual intercourse. He says, this cannot anger him. Could anger him to raise a spirit in his mistress's circle of some strange nature, letting it there stand till she had laid it and conjured it down. I think that some of the conservative pedagogues in authority or parents in or out of authority knew how riddled the play was. They wouldn't want their children to read it. I must just tell you a story to relate to this, if I may, but a break. When I was 15, I got a book voucher to go to our local bookshop, and I bought Chaucer. Why? I don't know. But it wasn't the original, it was Neville Cockle's brilliant translation. If you ever can get a wonderful translation, go for Neville Cockle, and it's wonderful. And I was reading Chaucer, and of course, mommy and daddy were saying, and then I was reading it and I came across, I didn't understand it, I came across the Miller's Tale, which is really totally obscene, wonderfully so. And I read that and my parents were at the dining table, I don't know, maybe they were giving accounts or something, and I walked in and I said, I've been reading The Miller's Tale. Really, darling? Yes. And would you like me to read it to you? Yes. And I started reading it. But of course, the most wonderful prince were 15-year-old. And my father jumped up. He was about to belt me. I said, but daddy, it's Chaucer. Then read it to yourself. However, let's look at the beautiful lyricism, the gorgeous imagery in Act 2, Scene 2, line 29, no, lines 2 to 9, 2-2, lines 2 to 9. Romeo is gazing with rapture at Juliet, who's just appeared, or without just here at the window without the balcony, became a soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east. And Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, who is already sick and pale with grief, that thou, her maid, art more fair than she. Be not her maid, since she is envious. Her best of livery is but sick and green, and none but fools wear it. Cast it off. But hold on, this is a really confused speech, because Romeo really mixed up the sun, the moon, and Juliet, which is understandable. Okay, but he's really passionately in love with Juliet. Yes, okay. And it seems that Julius Vestal Livery, which is but sick and green, she must actually cast it off, meaning she must get rid of her virginity. However, this shows that Romeo is after only one thing, and if he's going to have to marry the girl, then so be it. Let's just look at two of the other famous lines from the scene, Act 2, Scene 2, lines 43 and 44, where Juliet rationalizes, what's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other word, would smell as sweet. A rose. Who does Romeo lust after before Juliet? Rosaline. He actually could be saying this. That would be called a rose by any other word, the smell of sweet. Juliet. Okay. Right. So he's interested in any blue. The only difference between Juliet and Rosaline is that Juliet reciprocates his randomness. Romeo actually acknowledges this in Act 2, Scene 2, lines 85 to 87, when he explains to Friar Lawrence. He says this to Friar Lawrence, I pray thee, chide me not. Her I love now, doth grace for grace and love for love allow. The other did not serve. In other words, Friar Lawrence says, wait a second, just about Rosaline a few lines back, now Juliet. And he says, yeah, but the difference is she returns grace for grace and love for love. The other didn't. That's why I'm in love with Juliet and not with what's it. Okay. Therefore, Friar Lawrence in Act 2, Scene 2, lines 67 to 68, Act 2, Scene 3, lines 67 to 68 is accurate when he comments on Romeo's fickleness and says, young men's love, then, lies not truly in their hearts, but in their eyes, or in their cock pieces. But, because I'm going to stop at the end of the first sentence, young men's love, then, lies. You've got the ambiguity. And that is what Friar Lawrence is reminding us. What he's telling us, what he's telling himself. Okay. Then we have both of your hearts and eyes in Juliet's soliloquy in Act 3, Scene 2, lines 1 to 31. Her epithalamia, I've always wanted to use that word in lecture. Her epithalamia. Did anyone here ever have an epithalamia? I'm sure some of you certainly did. Yes, you know what it is? You should know what it is. Fun? You on the right here? An epithalamium, anyone? It's a wedding hymn. A wedding hymn. So this is Juliet's epithalamium wedding hymn as she waits for her lover. I won't read it all, I'll just read bits of it. It's really beautiful. Gather the pace, you fiery-footed steeds, towards Phoebus' lodging. Such a wagoner as Phaeton would whip you to the west and bring in cloudy night immediately. Spread thy closed curtain, love performing night. that runaway's eyes may wink, and Romeo leap to his arms, untalked of and unseen. Of course, leap, if you know from The Wife of Bath in Chaucer, under Thomas Perkins's, leap also means to make love. Okay, and she says, come, civil knight, thou sober suited matron born in black, and learn me how to lose a winning march, play for a pair of stainless maidenhoods. And learn me how, I'm believing in suspense, the word learn me how, remember that, Friday we look at that again. Then we've got the hawking imagery. Hood my unmanned blood, baiting my cheeks with thy black mantle, till strange love grow bold. He said to me, and still making the same speech, come, knight, come, Romeo, come, thou day and night, for thou wilt lie upon the wings of light. She does talk a lot, doesn't she? So where does that leave us? We can admire the beauty of the language. We can laugh at the riddled humor. We can feel for the lovers. We can cry, do cry when they die. We all can, or could, relate to the lovers. But if we want to get didactic, we can also say, so this is what happens when youngsters don't listen to their elders. Alternatively, so this is what happens when older people forget that they too were young once and they try to dictate their children's lives. And this is what we're going to see all the time. Who is right? Who is wrong? What would have happened if? Because in this case, everyone loses out in the end. We have examples throughout of the road to hell being paved with good intentions. Romeo intervenes in the fight between Tybalt and Mercutio. He tries to stop it. He asks for peace. And the result, Mercutio is killed because his guard is down and Tybalt fights and kills him. So what happens then? Romeo takes revenge and kills Tybalt. And then Romeo is banished. Juliet takes the sleeping potion. And so on. Friar Lawrence thinks that if he marries the two, peace might result between the Montagues and the Capulets, but only death follows. Dan Capulet, an odious creature, insists that Juliet marries Paris, thinking that he's doing the right thing. But it is really the worst decision he can make to his daughter. Benvolio, he actually manages to survive. Benvolio, Romeo's best friend, sums all up at the beginning, at one scene, one, lines 55 to 56, when he stops at a frat bar between the minor characters and shouts, "Park fools, put up your swords, you know not what you do." In this way, Romeo and Juliet is different from most other made in all of Shakespeare's plays. Let's look at the tragedies. Macbeth and his lady know what they're about. Iago certainly does too, as he manipulates Othello. Romeo and Juliet is the only one, as far as I can work out, that knows actually causing the major problems don't want the protagonist to die. They don't want harm to befall their loved ones. They act unwisely because of love. Friar Lawrence, Capulet, the nurse, and of course, both Romeo and Juliet. The only tragedy that is possibly a bit similar to this one is Antony and Cleopatra, with the eponymous heroes, one that plays named after, being like a middle-aged Romeo and Juliet. They're every bit as lustful, but they're more manipulative and powerful. Here too, we have one dying for the other. And he is told that Cleopatra is dead because she deceives him. He stabs himself, learns that he's still alive, and then conveniently gets back and dies in her arms. She then takes an aspirin, puts it to her breast, and dies as well. So Cleopatra actually wants Antony to die, and others do too, of course. Like Romeo and Juliet, then they do die, but unlike them, there's been not such a ridiculous legend put up around them as examples of what true love should be. Where Romeo and Juliet is also different on the whole, is that there is no evil Iago and Othello, no evil witch or chieftain or lady as in Macbeth, no evil children, Goneril and Regan, her spouses Edmund, as in King Lear, no wicked king as in Hamlet. Here what is wicked is actually society, and more specifically, the arrogance, the pride, the hard-headedness, and the hard-heartedness of the elders in society. It is blind to the feelings of others, and possibly it holds as great a lesson to us to learn from as we do from the jealousy of Othello, the ambition of Macbeth, the self-centeredness of Lear, and the vacillation of Hamlet. So Shakespeare, with the beauty, with the humor, is teaching us a lesson. We can learn from this play through the laughter and the tears. We can learn not just how to use wonderful imagery, but how to get insight into our own beings as well as the characters of others. On the other hand, imagine a youngster turning around to his girlfriend today and talking up Romans just so you get a line. It's very reminiscent of how many of our lady did. You saw, remember Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl? And when she's on stage, and now I do love ballet, but this is better. I thought it was really funny. And then there's her lover in Swan Lake, Siegfried, right? When he walks across to her on stage and he turns around to him and says, "Can't you walk up and warm a man?" Okay. People misconceive what Romeo and Juliet is really about. For instance, 14 months ago, a 79-year-old man in Victorian North shot himself. His wife saw the body, took the gun, and shot herself. She was absolutely distraught. The headline was, "Romeo and Juliet Life Suicide." But that wasn't. Not because they were old, but they weren't two people in antagonistic societies. There'd be no attempts to hold them apart. Not just because they loved each other, but called Romeo and Juliet. And we have, of course, Romeo and Juliet stories throughout the world. In the Serbian War, you might remember how this Serbian girl and Bosnian boy were trying to escape, and on the bridge they were shot down. And then later they were recovered and they lie together in the grave today. We had this between an Israeli girl and a Palestinian boy in Israel as well. And not long ago, we would have had this with black and white in South Africa. And we can still have it with Muslims and Hindus, Jews and Christians, when men love men and women, no matter what our constitution says. It's an outrageous. Okay. We do well to read Romeo and Juliet today, not just for the gorgeous imagery, and it is glorious, not just for the sexual illusions, and my gosh, it is really near to a knuckle, among other parts of the anatomy. Okay. Not just to see how well Shakespeare is able to combine different parts of society in one play. Not just to see how he can mix comedy with tragedy, lyricism with coarseness, but it allows us to look at ourselves and realize how we, should never fall into the traps made by the people of Verona. And we must try to make sure this never happens in Verulam, Viani, Victoria West, or Virginia. Or even in Verona. I believe there's a Verona estate in Nervinville, right? Up the road. Okay. The play Romeo and Juliet is relevant today. It's as relevant as it was 400 years ago. As relevant in South Africa as it was in Italy and England. It is good to turn to it periodically. It is good to return to this play periodically. It is good to bring it to the attention of our youngsters. But don't ever think it's a story of true love with a happy ending. May the gods forfend that those who call upon Romeo and Juliet, who visit Verona, who put messages on walls, who declaim from balconies, ever become like these star-crossed lovers, because that is what happens. Any comments, any questions at this stage? My time is good.
How about Shakespeare in Love?
Pardon?
The movie Shakespeare in Love.
Shakespeare in Love?
Yeah.
It was wonderful, wasn't it?
Well,
I enjoyed it. I don't think it's based on any truth whatsoever. But it was fun. It was fun. I don't think Judy Dench deserved the Oscar either. Even though she deserves the Oscar for everything else she does. Okay. Now, there are two things I want to say. Tomorrow, we'll look at The Two Gentlemen of Verona. It is a comedy, but it's really a sick comedy. Can I ask how many of you have actually made it? Thank you very much. That Act 5 is some of the worst Shakespearean writing I've read. It's on a par with Pericles and Tarsus of Oedipus. Okay, but it's really important to read, it's really important to know, because plot is tomorrow. We'll take a serious look tomorrow too at the geography of Verona and Milan. And show how Shakespeare actually gets it right, no matter what people think. And then something else, a little bit of a plug. A few months ago, my Animal Rights children's novel, The Story of Humphrey the Hereford, was published. Yes! Okay. I've had book launches in Pretoria, Johannesburg, and believe it or not, in Luxembourg. And I've been asked to do one in Cape Town as well. And I'd love it if you, those of you who could make it, want to make it, if you come tomorrow, it is at 18:30 to Erin Hall 8 in Rondebosch. I'll hand out flyers to you as you leave. Please let me know, and Gabby, you said you'd help me, thank you, at the other door. Please let me know if you think you can make it. If you can, it'll be catered, there'll be food, there'll be drink. And it would be great to see you there. I'll see you before that. I'll see you tomorrow. The Two Gentlemen of Verona. Yes?
I'm astonished at how many of Shakespeare's plays were set in Italy, particularly when you see that England and Italy were estranged after Henry came. Now, will you be touching on why that might be?
Why they were estranged? Yes?
No, not why they were estranged. Why so many of the plays were set in Italy?
I can answer that now, and I can't answer that now. It is not impossible that, okay, there are two things, that Shakespeare might have gone to Italy in the last years of his life, 1584 to 1592. It's also possible that that's where he got most of his sources from. Like the history plays he got from Hollandshed. And a lot of plays he would have found interesting had sources based in Italy. What I will do, however, on Thursday, I will be talking about Henry VIII and the biggest irony of his whole reign, which is related to Venice.
A few years ago, there was a theory that someone was writing a book, I wonder if you can tell us about it, that one of Shakespeare's relations, or a branch of the Shakespeare family,
all, I do know with all these theories, such as Charlton Ogburn, who talks about the Masque of Shakespeare, where he proves that Shakespeare couldn't have written Shakespeare, and he demolishes the man Shakespeare to prove that he'd never written it, and he sets up an Earl of Oxford as having written it, using the same argument that he just said doesn't work with Shakespeare. I've never read anything convincing that he wrote it or didn't write, except the important thing is the plays were written. So there's one question there, I saw, yes. Being here, I'll see you tomorrow.